Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
When the cost of living rises, how you invest matters even more. A financial advisor can help you make sense of it all. Now's the time to invest with advice. Visit dynamic.ca/advice to learn more.
Excitement here in New Zealand has been ignited for this tournament.
Hearing our fans being behind us is just unforgettable.
World football at the Women's World Cup from the BBC World Service.
We're going all the way, baby.
Find it wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Valerie Sanderson, and in the early hours of Friday, the 4th of August, these are our main stories. Donald Trump has pleaded not guilty to four charges at a court in Washington, including conspiring to overturn the result of the 2020 US presidential election. Satellite data from Brazil shows deforestation in the Amazon has dropped dramatically. A man has stabbed more than a dozen people in South Korea. Also in this podcast,
we took this bacteria which we had isolated and we infected these mosquitoes with the malaria parasite, and we found that it was the one responsible for reducing infection in these mosquitoes.
Scientists have found a natural strain of bacteria which they say could help stop the transmission of malaria from mosquitoes to humans. The former US President Donald Trump has pleaded not guilty to criminal charges that he conspired to overturn the results of the 2020 election and defraud the American people. He entered his plea in the same Washington courthouse where hundreds of his supporters were convicted for their roles in the attack on the US Capitol in January 2021. Mr. Trump, the front runner for the Republican presidential nomination next year, said it was a very sad day for America. Reporting from Washington, here's our correspondent, Sean Dilley.
Donald Trump arrived at court with a Secret Service motorcade after flying in from his Bedminster golf resort in New Jersey. Dressed in a dark suit, blue shirt and trademark red tie, he entered the courtroom accompanied by his lawyers without speaking to reporters. He listened intently as the prosecution read out the charges. Mr. Trump was asked to enter a plea. Denying all charges, he said slowly and deliberately, "Not guilty." Prosecutors did not oppose bail, which the judge granted, but she told him not to talk about the facts of the case. Failure to comply with this condition, she said, could result in an arrest warrant being issued, contempt of court charges, and potential custody. Mr. Trump was driven straight from the court to the nearby Reagan Airport, where he spoke to reporters.
"This is a persecution of a political opponent. This was never supposed to happen in America. This is the persecution of the person that's leading by very, very substantial numbers in the Republican primary and leading Biden by a lot. So if you can't beat him, you persecute him or you prosecute him. We can't let this happen in America."
Donald Trump's next court date is the 28th of August. The former president has been told he doesn't have to attend.
Sean Dilley in Washington. Michael Gerhardt is a constitutional lawyer and distinguished professor of jurisprudence at the University of North Carolina, who testified at Donald Trump's impeachment proceedings and also at the process involving Bill Clinton. Rebecca Kesby asked him if this latest case is more important than any of the other cases that Mr. Trump has faced so far.
I think they're all important, or another way to think of it is they're each becoming increasingly important. John Adams once talked about how this is a country of government. We have a government of laws, not men. And that's what's being tested, because the law should apply to everyone equally. And Trump seems to, based on the evidence that has been amassed, to have engaged in a series of acts that were designed to impede the peaceful transfer of power in the United States. That's been a bedrock principle here in the United States, that the loser sort of kind of acknowledges that and then goes away, doesn't try to create any kind of violence or rebellion or any kind of havoc in the aftermath of the election. Mr. Trump obviously did just the opposite.
Can you tell us anything else about how this trial may be conducted? Is it going to be televised? Will there be a jury? If it's a grand jury, what does that mean?
It will not be a grand jury. So the grand jury's function in our legal system is to charge somebody with a crime. That's already been done. So now the ball sort of goes into the court of the federal district judge who's going to oversee Trump's trial. And then all those questions are really left for her to answer. Will she allow television into the courtroom? When, if at all, would she do that? She will oversee the selection of a jury, which is supposed to include people that don't already have prejudices about this matter. She's going to be a tough judge. That's her reputation. And I mean that in the best sense. She doesn't take any nonsense. She's been tough on people that have come before her in the past who participated in the riots at the Capitol. She's handed out tough sentences. But she also came to her judgeship from having been a public defender. And that means she's very aware of and sensitive to the rights of criminal defendants. And she'll be even-handed. But in Mr. Trump's case, that might not be welcome. He wants somebody who's already sort of biased in his favor. He doesn't have that here.
Interesting. Michael, just a quick word on what we know of the other co-conspirators. What can you tell us about that?
Well, these are all people who really worked for Mr. Trump in the administration. So they're fellow Democrats. They're people he appointed to positions of power. So this is not a conspiracy, so to speak, of Democrats that are kind of going after Mr. Trump. Instead, it's his fellow Republicans are the ones that helped him attempt to undermine the election, and also people that had high-ranking positions. The acting Attorney General of the United States is among them. It's a very serious problem that these six co-conspirators were all people that wielded enormous power, but they did his bidding in trying to impede the peaceful transfer of power.
The constitutional lawyer, Michael Gerhardt. When President Lula da Silva returned to power in Brazil in January, he promised to reverse the damage done to the rainforest by his predecessor, Jair Bolsonaro. Official figures from Brazil's space research agency seem to show he's on the right track, as I heard from our correspondent in Brazil, Katie Watson.
INPE, which is the Brazilian space research agency, they monitor the Amazon through satellites, and they said that in the month of July, 500 square kilometres of rainforest was cleared, and that's a 66% drop from the same period a year ago. And even if you look at the first 7 months of this year compared to the 7 months of last year, deforestation has fallen 42.5%. So these are massive, massive drops in the first half of 2023 since Lula da Silva came back to be Brazil's president.
And how has he done it?
If you look at the surveillance, that's gone up. So during Jair Bolsonaro's time in power, he cut resources, which meant there weren't as many people on the ground in terms of finding people who did things that they shouldn't be doing in the Amazon, like deforesting or planting things they shouldn't, or putting cattle on land that they shouldn't be doing that. He's increased that surveillance. In fact, the amount of fines rose 150%, practically about $400 million worth of fines were collected in the first half of 2023. So he's really just upped the surveillance, upped the policing, if you like, of the Amazon in Brazil.
And you've just interviewed him, haven't you, President Lula? What did he tell you?
These figures come in the context of a summit that's being hosted in Belém, which is in the Amazon. That's where Brazil's going to host the COP climate summit in 2 years' time. He's bringing eight countries that share the Amazon rainforest together in the city to discuss how to preserve the rainforest. I mean, he seemed hopeful that the region can play a big part in trying to solve climate issues.
Então, esta reunião é a primeira grande oportunidade.
This meeting is the first great opportunity for people to show the world what we want to do. If we have the political will and common sense, we will do it. Brazil will fulfill what was promised. We will reach zero deforestation in the Amazon in 2030.
And Katie, is there any active opposition to this? I mean, will he be able to achieve his goal of stopping deforestation altogether by the end of the decade?
Well, this is Brazil, and in politics, there's certainly an awful lot of people who don't like Lula. Clearly, people who had been allowed to, there were fewer regulations in the last 4 years and were allowed to do more than they are now, might not be so happy about it. Whether or not he is able to achieve his goal of stopping deforestation, I think it will be incredibly difficult to get it down to zero. but he's certainly committed with other countries to try and bring that number down. When I spoke to him, he said that people need to look at this region and stop just talking and actually doing. So the commitment's there. Whether or not it's overambitious, I think everybody's going to be watching that.
Katie Watson in Brazil. France has condemned the suspension of the state-run radio and television broadcasters in Niger following last week's coup, describing the move as authoritarian repression. Niger has been an important ally for France, which, like America, has a military presence there to fight jihadists in the region. But relations have soured since the coup 9 days ago, when hundreds of French nationals were evacuated from the country after protesters attacked the French embassy. On Thursday, protests were held in Niger's capital, Niamey, in support of the military coup. Our Africa correspondent, Catherine Biarahanga, has compiled this report.
Long live the Nigerian army, a nation for the patriots, crowds chanted in Niger's capital. Thousands gathered in front of parliament to show support for the country's new military leaders who are facing a chorus of international calls to step down. It's also Independence Day in Niger, and the rallies focused on hostility to France, the country's former colonial power, which still has troops in the country. Some Nigerians, like this protester, are also angry with the West African regional grouping known as ECOWAS, which has condemned the coup.
We are going to demonstrate to all the ECOWAS countries and all those who are taking unpopular and inhumane measures against Niger, which is in the process of freeing itself from the yoke of colonization.
Some in the crowd waved Russian flags, like neighboring Burkina Faso and Mali, which have also experienced recent coups. Some believe drawing closer to Moscow offers better economic and security prospects. But there is also a sizable part of Niger's population that wants a return to civilian rule and who have carried out their own protests in the past few days. Regional efforts at mediation have so far failed to convince the soldiers of Niger to go back to their barracks.
Catherine Biarahanga. At least 12 people have been injured in South Korea after a man drove a car into pedestrians and then attacked many of them with a knife. The incident happened south of the capital, Seoul. Jean McKenzie has more details.
The suspect, dressed all in black, drove his car onto the pavement during the evening rush hour, ramming into four people. He then got out, brandishing a knife, and walked into a busy shopping centre, where he stabbed at least nine others. All of the injured have been taken to hospital. Some are said to be seriously hurt. At the scene, police have arrested a man in his 20s. South Korea's National Police Commissioner has described this as an indiscriminate attack. It follows another random stabbing in Seoul a fortnight ago, in which one person was killed.
Jean McKenzie. Now to a possible breakthrough in preventing the transmission of malaria from mosquitoes to humans. Scientists at a GlaxoSmithKline research facility in Spain have discovered a naturally occurring strain of bacteria which, over time, inhibits the development of malaria parasites in a mosquito's gut. More research is taking place following the discovery, but it's being seen as a potentially significant tool that could be used to combat the spread of the disease, which in 2021 accounted for the deaths of more than 600,000 people around the world. Julian Warwicker spoke to the author of the research from GlaxoSmithKline, Janet Rodriguez.
We froze down those tissue samples in our freezers and took this bacteria, which we had isolated. We put it into a new colony, which was established in our insectary, and we infected these mosquitoes with the malaria parasite. And yes, we found that it was the one responsible for reducing infection in these mosquitoes.
So yeah. this is effectively a natural bacteria, which you've now discovered inhibits the development of the malaria parasites in a mosquito's gut.
Exactly.
That's what you've now found.
Yes.
And how significant is that, potentially?
Oh, potentially, it is tremendously significant because all of the currently used vector control tools, or those which are in development, these target the mosquito itself. So they kill the mosquito vector. And because of that, there is high chances for development of resistance. And resistance to insecticides is now one of the major challenges for mosquito vector control. So that's the reason why this kind of intervention has an added advantage.
And also it would mean that those particular mosquitoes would no longer threaten humans with malaria.
Exactly.
What's then the potential application of this on the kind of scale that would make a difference around the world?
So looking into the future, I mean, we would like to see this used, of course, deployed as a tool or deployed as the tool for the prevention of malaria. But what we see from this study, what we concluded from this study is that we not only have the TC1 bacteria, which could be used as an active ingredient to be incorporated into potential vector control tools. We have three different potential active ingredients which have arisen from this TC1 based intervention.
Right. So in those circumstances, yeah, the mosquitoes would absorb that bacteria based intervention.
Exactly.
And that would have the effect of nullifying the mosquito's gut and being able to pass on malaria. There was a particular figure added to this, that this strain can reduce a mosquito's parasite load by up to 73%. Is that right?
Yes.
And in terms of that wider application, what happens now in terms of trying to make the difference everybody wants it to make for those who might be at risk of malaria?
So the advantage we have is that, one, it is a non-genetically engineered microorganism. It is naturally present in the environment. So based on these preliminary experiments, we are doing additional rounds of experiments to ensure that we do have good efficacy, good uptake of this bacteria in the mosquito gut, and also to ensure safety within the environs of that mosquito sphere.
What's the timescale for all this in terms of when it becomes a practical application?
It's too early to say because these are just the preliminary studies. So it would be too speculative to talk about, you know, timelines right now.
But put it into context for us. When we think of all the other developments there have been in recent times, where does this one sit?
I wish I could answer that, because right now what we have is we don't have a final product format.
But it's a good day.
It is a good day. It's a very good day.
Janeth Rodriguez from GlaxoSmithKline. Still to come, why fish skin is being used to treat wounds.
With fish, there is no virus that can be transferred from a fish to a man. There's no mad cod disease, and that's what does the good in the healing.
Hi, I'm Hannah. I am the host of a new daily podcast, What in the World, from the BBC World Service, where we try to help you make sense of the world around you, explaining the big events and some of the smaller events, so that you might feel a little bit better when you pick up your phone and scroll through your newsfeed. Just search for What in the World wherever you get your BBC podcasts and hit subscribe.
Welcome back to the Global News Podcast. A senior Ukrainian military figure says it was one of their teams which struck the Kerch Bridge linking Russia with Crimea last month. The attack temporarily stopped traffic on a strategically important route. Russia blamed marine-based drones. Here's Pomos.
There was a time when Ukraine didn't comment on operations behind enemy lines, but the authorities in Kyiv have recently become more candid and have now claimed responsibility for blowing up part of the Kerch Bridge last month. By linking Russia with occupied Crimea, the bridge has come to symbolise Russia's territorial conquests. But the secretary of Ukraine's National Defence and Security Council mocked the idea that the bridge was heavily protected. Oleksiy Danilov said many Russian facilities were labelled untouchable, but that Ukraine was putting that claim where it belonged.
Paul Moss. Well, conflicts like the one in Ukraine have been taking place throughout history. Ways to treat those wounded in war are constantly being developed via new medical techniques. But sometimes the most simple ideas have extraordinary outcomes. A British surgeon, Stephen Jeffrey, a professor specialising in the study of wounds, has worked in several war zones. He told Martha Carney that specially treated fish skin proves invaluable when treating soldiers injured on the modern battlefield.
It facilitates and promotes and speeds up wound healing. And when you're in a mass casualty situation where you have more casualties than you can operate on, one of the things I bring with me is this fish skin, because it will, by speeding up the process of wound healing, it will allow more patients to be treated.
And just so people can know what it looks like, it's a rather kind of papery, thin, white piece of, almost looks like parchment, but I can see the sort of traces of what will look like scales, or, you know, where scales have been on it. And how exactly does it work?
Well, this is freeze-dried, so when you wet it, it sort of rehydrates and then it becomes more pliable. And when you normally take an animal product and you want to use it on a human, you have to process it very thoroughly to get rid of any risk of viral transmission. You know, is it going to contain hepatitis, HIV, mad cow disease, anything like this? And doing that, you get rid of a lot of the structure and a lot of the goodness of the chemicals that promote healing. And it turns out that with fish, there is no virus that can be transferred from a fish to a man. There's no mad cod disease. So the processing is a lot more gentle. It retains a lot more of that good structure, for example, the omega-3 fatty acids, and that's what does the good in the healing.
And is this part of a trend in a way that we're going back to what might seem to be more traditional, old-fashioned remedies?
Well, certainly we are rediscovering that what our ancestors used, not all of it was mumbo-jumbo, some of it actually works. The other good thing about the fish skin is it's a form of recycling, because this is skin that's come from the food industry. You know, we eat the cod, and previously they would throw away the skin. But now that can be processed and turned into a very useful product for wound healing.
The British surgeon, Stephen Jeffrey. Now to Romania, where the government has been implementing policies to try to persuade its diaspora to move back home. Almost 20% of the population live elsewhere, and that causes issues particularly in the health and construction sectors in the country. Tessa Dunlop has been meeting those who've decided to return home to Romania.
That is actually a plastic hammer banging soft Italian leather in a Transylvanian workshop.
What are you making there?
It's a skirt with suspenders. We're basically hammering the seams to make them nice and flat so we can make the final stitch.
I'm in Cluj-Napoca, a city in the west of Romania and one of its richest, with fashion designer Alina Morar. She returned here in 2019, having spent 5 years in London. I asked her why she'd originally left her homeland.
Now it's a bit better, but back then, 10 years ago, I had blue hair, like everyone was making fun and pointing fingers at me. You know, self-expression wasn't big.
What brings you back? What pulls you back to Romania?
On Facebook, and some members of my family told me that there are this funding that's been offered to people that have been living outside of Romania for at least 1 year. It's a funding for startups, for people that have an idea about something they want to do. It doesn't have to be, I didn't even have to have a company. I just needed to have an idea and a business plan put together with something that I wanted to do.
With the help of EU funds, in 2014, the government introduced diaspora grants. Alina got 33,000 euros. That's roughly 37,000 US dollars. And it's not the only policy being used to tempt the diaspora home. The mayor of Cluj-Napoca, Emil Boc, was prime minister of Romania just after the country joined the European Union in 2007. Hundreds of thousands of people were leaving every year.
Unfortunately, the entrance of Romania in the European Union was followed by the economic crisis. So it was accelerating the migration process. We were in the situation not to have money to pay pension and salaries.
And what impact did that have here on the ground in Romania?
We had to cancel projects because there were no people in construction. We have money, but no people to work and to finalize a bridge or a street or something like that. We had to close sometimes hospitals. We had, in the worst case scenario possible, a combination of losing people and economic crisis.
The scale of the exodus was terrifying, but these days Romania is a changed place. Aided by an EU boost of 30 billion euros, it's projected to be the third fastest growing economy in the European Union this year. Of all the policies the Romanian government's introduced to get the diaspora back, their most successful has been in the health sector. In 2018, they increased salaries by around 70% overnight. And by 2021, the number of doctors applying to work abroad had almost halved. Ioana Biris is a fetal cardiologist and spent almost a decade working for Britain's National Health Service. She's just moved home to Timișoara, which is this year's European Capital of Culture.
We have decided to come back right in time in Timișoara because there's a lot of festivals happening in Timișoara, which I don't recall this happening 10, 15 years ago. And I think you feel much more up to date with what's happening in the world.
For some, though, the policies aren't cutting through. And life on a lower salary often seems better in Western Europe. The government's introduced tax breaks for the construction industry, but builder Jon is still struggling to find the staff.
He's saying, as an example, I had the construction site and I had no people, absolutely no people to work with. I pay my workers 1,000 euros a month. That's the same amount of money that the worker in Italy would earn, but they still don't want to come back.
That report by Tessa Dunlop. Here in Britain, five people have been arrested after they climbed onto the roof of the British Prime Minister's home in northern England to protest against his fossil fuel policies. The demonstrators from the climate group Greenpeace draped black fabric over the house. The activists also laid out a banner on the front lawn reading, "Rishi Sunak, oil profits are our future." This week, he'd approved hundreds of new oil and gas exploration licenses in the North Sea, angering environmentalists. From North Yorkshire, Fiona Trott reports.
On a quiet lane in North Yorkshire, police cars still surround the Prime Minister's family home. Inside the grounds, in front of a union flag, you can see ladders propped up next to a CCTV camera. The investigation into how this happened is well underway. Protesters wearing harnesses and hard hats climbed onto the roof. Footage released by the campaign group Greenpeace appear to show them walking onto the property unchallenged. The Conservative MP, Greg Clark, said the breach of security was a real concern.
The home of the Prime Minister should be secure. I think everyone would accept this. We know the risks and the dangers. I'm not saying that these protesters had in mind violent intent, but that doesn't matter.
Another senior Tory backbencher, Alicia Kearns, said politicians' family homes should not be under assault. The former Deputy Chief Constable of North Yorkshire Police, Peter Walker, says the situation could have been much worse.
There is an opportunity here for somebody who wants to attack the Prime Minister to place an improvised explosive device at the premises, and I really hope they're going to be checked after all this is over. It seems to me that there ought to have been a police presence at the home. The fact that it has been left unattended is astonishing.
Three men and two women remain in custody as detectives continue to investigate why the Prime Minister's home was not safe and secure.
Fiona Trott in Northern England. The American pop star Lizzo has denied allegations that she sexually harassed and fat-shamed three of her former dancers. They've filed a lawsuit against the singer, who called the accusations unbelievable. Our entertainment correspondent Colin Patterson reports. I do my
hair, talk, check my nails. Lizzo has won Grammys and many devoted fans who love her messages of inclusivity and body positivity. 36 hours after being faced with a lawsuit containing allegations of body shaming, sexual harassment, and having created a hostile work environment, Lizzo responded with a lengthy statement on social media. She described the allegations as false, unbelievable, and too outrageous to not be addressed, saying that it had never been her intention to make anyone feel uncomfortable and that she would never criticise or fire an employee because of their weight. The three dancers who are bringing the case against Lizzo gave me their reaction to Lizzo's statement. Crystal Williams and Ariana Davis were both sacked by the singer. Noelle Rodriguez resigned in protest. Speaking from their lawyer's office in Los Angeles, Ariana Davis responded to Lizzo's comment that she was not the villain she'd been made out to be.
She's less of a villain and more of an anti-hero to me. And what that means to me is that a villain is someone with no redeemable qualities. They are bad and evil and terrible, But an anti-hero is someone who does bad things but has redeemable qualities. Do I think Lizzo can take this and change and be who she says she is? Yes, absolutely. I want her to be who she said she was when I first met her.
Crystal Williams said it had never been their intention for the three to go public.
This was worst case scenario. It was a last resort. There were several attempts made to try to handle this privately. I multiple times asked to speak with her.
The BBC has asked Lizzo for an interview, but there has been no response.
Colin Paterson. And finally, the composer Carl Davis, who wrote the music for more than 100 films and television series, has died at the age of 86. He was born in New York but had lived in the UK since the early 1960s. A versatile and prolific musician, he composed scores in a wide range of styles for films including The French Lieutenant's Woman and television series such as Pride and Prejudice. Sophie van Bruggen looks back at his life.
Carl Davis's music for the BBC's Pride and Prejudice. Like so many of his works, it was tuneful and just right for the purpose. He arrived in Britain in 1961. From then on, themes and incidental music poured from his pen, for everything from The World at War to Ben-Hur to Torvald and Dean's Fire and Ice. From the 1970s, he became the world's foremost composer of music for silent films. He wrote and adapted a mammoth 5 hours of music for a restored version of Abel Garce's 1927 masterpiece, Napoleon.
Ah, Sophie van Bruggen there on the life of the composer Carl Davis, who's died at the age of 86. And that's it from us for now, but there'll be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on Twitter at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Daniel Ehrlich. The producer was Liam McSheffrey. The editor, as ever, is Karen Martin. I'm Valerie Sanderson. Until next time, goodbye.